The True False podcast is made possible with the support of the University of Missouri and the Donald W. Reynolds Journalism Institute.
Welcome to the True False Film Festival.
This is the True False podcast, presented by KBIA. I'm Allison Kofeldt. Today, we'll hear a conversation between True False's David Wilson and director Kitty Green, whose film Casting JonBenet was shown at True False in 2017. Casting JonBenet is one in a recent line of documentaries that focuses on the casting process. So a casting doc is when you have a film that's about making another film, and you record the process of finding actors or staging reenactments. And that footage, the footage which shows the act of recreation, becomes the film itself. With documentary, of course, the actors and reenactments are rendering something that really happened. Casting JonBenet puts a microscope on the community of Boulder, Colorado, and the people who have lived in the shadow of the JonBenet Ramsey murder for more than 20 years. The film's casting tapes feature local actors who talk about the case and the impact it's had on their lives. David talked with Kitty about interview strategies and style choices in this type of documentary.
So much of the film succeeds on your interviewing strategies and your technique. And I think in some ways maybe it gets lost behind like the incredible perfection of your visual form, but like all that visual form doesn't really amount to anything if you haven't like delivered these really incredible interviews. And I'm super curious about how you go about that. And to start with, I guess, how much time did you have with each person who we meet in the course of that film?
About like 30 minutes, 45 minutes probably for each is how we scheduled them. But some people would run long, and then some people straight away you could tell, oh, this person's not going to give me much, so we'll just move along. But that was the approximate time. And so I think it was 200 people all up interviewed, and 72 of them are in the film.
Wow.
So it's quite a big number. But yeah, the key for all that, I think, is like having a trusting relationship. We needed them to trust us. So we were very, well, especially it's a small team, was very open about what I wanted the project to be, how this material would be used, how I envisioned it coming together, which is difficult for anyone to imagine because there's nothing else like it. I would give them all, everyone that sat down, a 10-minute speech about how I thought this material would be used and what the film was trying to do, and ask them if they wanted to be involved in the experiment. And I think all of them, there was maybe one or two that said no, and then most of the others were happy to just jump down the rabbit hole with us, is what we say.
I want like the Cliff Notes version of that speech. Like, how do you prep me for this when I sit down with you?
Wow, it was a long time ago.
But, I know.
It was basically saying I'd made a short film that had won the prize at Sundance, where the casting tapes formed the bulk of the film. That we were making a film about JonBenet Ramsey's community in Boulder, Colorado. Not about the case, I don't think we said not about the case. It is about the case. The most important aspect is the community and how they are dealing with the fact that this crime has never been solved, how they deal with the ambiguity, the uncertainty and doubt. And so I'm interested in that. And so everything you say could be used in some form. And, I would say don't confess if you killed her, like don't confess. But I think it was that sort of thing. I was sort of, yeah, vaguely that. They would have some questions about certain things. I mean, I also want to point out, though,
yes,
that I think the key to those interviews was that it was just me and a tiny camera in a room with them. And then I had a crew of my cinematographer and my production designer and my costume designer who were behind like a wall that they couldn't see. I mean, and I look like a child, like I'm not, I'm 32, but I look young. And so everyone, that idea that people could open up because it was just us in the space, as opposed to having a crew of people and mics and big cameras, and it looked very lo-fi and it just felt very intimate. I think that was how we got kind of the best content out of people.
Do you have follow-up interviews with people who do well, who you realize have a lot more to say?
We brought back, so the people that auditioned for John and Patsy, our favorites, we brought back and put in an interrogation room, which was like a fake interrogation room that we right. made, like a set of it. So they all came back for it, which becomes the third act. They all came back for that sequence. So that was the only time we ever interviewed people twice.
Got
it. For that.
So, okay, so I think this is incredible. Like, I think that like with 30 or 45 minutes to take people to where you take them, give us a like the broad picture of that. Like what, how are you guiding them along a path?
The weird thing about the project was like what I got, I wanted, but the thing I didn't understand was how easy it would be to get there. Like, I mean, I think there's something about that case and the fact that it is unsolved and they've been living in the shadow of it for 20 years that it does stir up a lot of emotions in people. So like immediately when I start asking about the case, they're off. You know what I mean? I didn't have to push them. It was really organic, like the process. So it would be almost like I just asked them about JonBenet Ramsey and they're automatically talking about their mother having bipolar disorder. They're automatically talking about their brother or their son or, you know, the relationship with a girlfriend who passed away. And the strange thing and the thing I did not expect in terms of like the most surprising thing was how open they were with me and how quickly they were led into those spaces and how I really didn't have to push or try and get things out of people that they were reluctant to divulge. Do you know what I mean? These people were happy to talk. It was cathartic. It was therapeutic. Like it was really a beautiful experience, I think, for all of us involved.
Maybe this is too nuts and bolts and we'll see if it makes sense. But like, do you have people repeat things? Do you have people like give you like heads or tails of statements that, you know, you can like, you know, cut with later?
I had to because of the way this film is constructed in that we don't cut away from anyone
right
during their while they're speaking. We're on them. There's no overlays or like a b-roll. So like normally in a documentary, to get around awkward bits and pieces or things that don't make sense, you just stick a drone shot of a desert or something over the top of it and then you make all these edits in what they're saying, and that's how you make this very neat, succinct piece of work. And here we can't cut away. It's a casting tape. There is no B-roll. So we have to stay with the people. And so when they go on a tangent, if they go on too long a tangent, it's almost like I have to sort of go, oh, we might have to, yeah, could we tell that again? But let's not like not go all the way too far down that path, but just tell me that story again. And they go, oh, okay, cool. And would often do it. But then sometimes you lose the beauty in the retelling and often right. end up using the first one anyway with the crazy tangent in it. But yeah, there was a lot of thinking that through because that's a very different way to make a documentary than actually, and my editor struggled with it the most because he's used to making straight docs. So he's used to being able to cut into speech and change and shorten things and make things easier to understand. And this for this project, we could not do that at all.
I feel like with the net you cast, it's both fair to call all these people actors because they're clearly, you know, at various stages of being professional, semi-professional, community actors. Did that help, you think, in terms of how they were as storytellers and telling their own stories? Was that something you were conscious of going in?
To be honest, I don't think so, because a lot of them, I mean, maybe it did. Gosh, I've never been asked that before. But I mean, yeah, I think inherently people that are interested in acting or the field of acting are interested in stories and storytelling. And I think maybe, without me realizing it, that played a bigger part in what we were in putting together this film. The thing I will say, though, is that they're real people first and actors second. And so, like, they're doing community theater in their spare time. They're, most of the days, they're a landscape gardener, you know, shoveling snow. And then they do a piece like a community theater show once a year or something. So they're real people. Whereas I don't think this film would have worked if we did it in Hollywood, where their lives are geared around the entertainment industry, where they're kind of desperate for that next gig. It's all about the work. Like it's all about the job. The thing that was beautiful about this is that they're part-time actors or not even, you know, like aspiring actors, but they actually have full rich lives that they can draw on in terms of this material. So yeah, that worked for us well.
In that process and in those interviews, and I think you sort of answered this, but like there was this quote I pulled out. I probably wouldn't have been able to have this conversation or talk like this when we first met a few months back. I hadn't been diagnosed with cancer yet.
He says that in the interrogation room set, which is the only time we brought actors back.
Right.
So we did the original casting material when we had very little money. And then we came back and did the final casting tapes when we had funding.
You saw something in him, you saw something in his interview that was worth bringing him back, but then he kind of goes one step further. And, like, I mean, obviously he has this major life, catastrophic life moment that happens, like, while you're away.
Yeah.
Was that planned? Yeah.
Was that hard?
Can you tell me, was that hard for you? I mean, like, that must be, like, that's so intense to, like, sit down with someone in that kind of moment.
He wasn't sure he wanted to be a part of the film. And I said to him in the end, I was like, okay, up to you. Whatever you want to do, I'm going to leave your slot open. So, like, we had an hour-long slot to interview him. He came, and I think it was a really good thing. Well, he talked about it being a good thing to just get out of his... I feel like when you... I mean, a lot of people talk about when you get, like, diagnosed with something like cancer, it takes over and you are the cancer as opposed to being you. But also it gave him a forum to discuss it. So, like, it was a kind of an interesting kind of experience for him. In the end, he was really grateful for the opportunity because it was something that was... could get his mind off everything that's going on in his life.
You mentioned the guy, and this is one of my favorite moments in the film. The guy auditioning to play the dad, and he talks about his girlfriend dying in bed next to him and waking him to discover that. And I think the last thing he says is something along the lines of, I'm sure he was going through a lot of that same stuff. And then his face, like, screws up. Like, and he's, like, just so clearly thinking about what that sentiment means in terms of this, like, larger story and in terms of JonBenet's story. It's, like, this incredible internal moment for him. Do you remember that interview? Do you remember that moment? Do you remember, like, where that was in the context of, like, working with this, you know, with this actor, but who had just sort of divulged an incredibly personal moment?
Yeah. I mean, it's tough to remember moment by moment, but the weird thing about this is you never know what's going to come out of these people's mouths, and we were constantly shocked. It was quite traumatic, actually, doing it, because it'd be 45 minutes of somebody's sort of deeply personal, painful stories again and again all day. Actually, that was the most tiring part of the process, was those casting tapes, because we felt like we were just getting knocked around all day by people, by all this pain.
Coming up, Kitty talks about how people have perceived a film about interpretation.
My cast in Colorado are writing to me saying, this is condescending, and can we please write to them and tell them that we had a voice in this?
First, a word from our sponsor. Hey, listeners, it's Allison, letting you know that this episode of the True False podcast is brought to you by the University of Missouri. That is, in fact, where we are making the show right now. We're here in the KBIA studios at the University of Missouri School of Journalism, which is famous for the Missouri Method. Here to tell us what the heck the Missouri Method is our podcast producer and MU journalism student, Abby Ivory Gagne.
Hey.
Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
What's been, like, a highlight for you?
I came in for a reporting shift one day. It was my second ever, and I got assigned a breaking story, and I followed it. And then the next morning, I was in line at Starbucks when somebody texted me and said they heard my story on NPR.
Sounds like you're getting a lot of good experience. Thanks, Abby.
Thanks, Allison.
And we also want to thank the University of Missouri for their generous support of this podcast. This episode of the True False podcast is brought to you by the Donald W. Reynolds Journalism Institute, which is currently taking applications for its 2018-2019 fellowships. Here to tell us more is current RJI fellow Chris Gass. Hey, Chris.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. So what's your elevator pitch for your project?
Sure. If you're a small and medium-sized news organization, if you're a local paper or radio station, getting on board with modern mobile news app systems is expensive and probably not really an option for you. So this is something that lets you basically take a pre-made system, modify it to your needs. In a couple days, you can have a completely native iOS and Android apps for all your readers.
Oh, yeah. That sounds amazing.
Yeah, it's a lot cheaper than the $50K that it usually costs. So.
Yeah, and this would be free, open source.
Completely free. Anybody can take it. Anybody can download it. You change a couple config files. You might have to hire a developer for like 2 or 3 days. That's what RJ is letting me work on.
Chris, again, he is a current Reynolds Journalism Institute fellow, and the Reynolds Journalism Institute is currently taking applications for its 2018-2019 fellowships. So if you're interested in learning more about those fellowships, you can visit rjionline.org, and the deadline to apply for those fellowships is January 31st, 2018, so check it out. You're listening to the True False podcast, presented by KBIA. I'm Allison Kofeld. In this episode, we've got a conversation with Kitty Green, director of casting JonBenet. She spoke with True False's own David Wilson.
Let's talk a little bit about the aesthetic style, you know, and how you, what you brought to that. And I mean, I honestly think, like, you hit as high a mark as I've seen with these, like, sort of recreation scenes in terms of, like, a really defined aesthetic for them. And one of the things that's immediately obvious is you use these different aspect ratios to define, like, the narrative space and the interview space or whatever. What else did you do? Like, what other things were you sort of like, here's how I'm going to, like, make these different spaces and here's how I'm going to delineate these?
I mean, not much. The aspect ratio was sort of something we decided really early on, but then as we kept going, there were scenes that were a blend of casting, mm-hmm. tape, and behind the scenes, and fiction, and it became almost like we got caught in our own,
right?
Like we painted ourselves into a corner in terms of what we could do with the aspect ratio. So, part of me, I mean, I'm not, yeah. If I was making the film again, I would think that through in a very different way. I mean, but at the same time, I mean, the main thing is we had, so every casting tape, we built a set. But we always had an exposed wall or a C-stand or, if you know what that is, it like connects a light, like mm-hmm. light stands, ladders. So we always, in any casting tape, that we always had evidence that this was just a casting tape. There was always some sign of the set or the process or the filmmaking process, I guess. So that was really important. So we were really careful about what that was and that we didn't double up. There wasn't like a ladder in every tape. Because that would be kind of dull. So that was probably the distinguishing marker between, and then the fiction elements, we were very clear to make sure that they were purely, beautifully lush, cinematic fiction scenes. So, I mean, that's probably the two biggest differences with that. They were shot on different cameras, but you can't tell that really because they both came up so beautifully that our high-end cinematic camera almost looks as good as our cheap casting tape camera. So, I mean, there was a few different things going on like that. But, I mean, they were lit similarly. They were lit so that it wasn't such so jarring mm-hmm. to go from one to the other.
Right. So. And then the final shot before the coda, that's a cut. Like, we actually, in that, you blend them together, right? Like, we're moving from the fiction action and we're pulling back and we're revealing all of the making of. And I think that's the first time you really do that within one shot, right? Where we really take us, where you pull us out like that.
Yeah, we had an opening shot that was a similar thing and we lost it. But we did used to open, like not open the film, but open that early cinematic sequence with a similar thing, pulling back, showing the crew. But we felt like it was too early to do that. So we ended up losing it. So yeah, I think that is the first time that it's done in that way. And it's a pullback.
You mentioned in that the reception to the film and why you feel like people might have been suspicious of you. But like, it's more than that. Like, people, even smart people, I think really failed in terms of how they like received the film and especially how they wrote about the film. And how did that feel for you?
I mean, it's so tough. It's a film that's about interpretation. So it's a film about how this community, how each of them interpreted these events, how they processed them individually. That's essentially what this film is about. So if I'm laying that out, is this what the film is about? It's a Rorschach test for, that's how we define it. So then reviewers are free to interpret it however they want. I can't really then get angry if people are reading it in different ways because it touches people in very different ways. Like some people find it incredibly emotional. Some people find it incredibly funny. Some people find it disturbing or horrendous. I loved that. I loved sort of reading everybody's, seeing how people were interpreting what is a film about interpretation. But yeah, I mean, it does get tough. This is the other thing. This is why I was reluctant to do a lot of press about it because it's almost like I don't want to guide anyone. I don't want to like almost pollute or corrupt a viewer's experience of it. I want them to go in and experience it the way they would. So as soon as I start to talk about the way I see things, then I think it would influence the way that an audience would. So yeah, I'm reluctant to even to comment on that.
So in the coda of the film, you do more than suggest. I think you sort of just come out and say, this story is America. Do you agree?
It is an American story. And I think that was my fascination with it as an Australian I had this idea, like, as a kid, I would watch Full House and The Brady Bunch. I had this idea about what family life in America was like. And I think I was 11 when this JonBenet Ramsey case happened, and that completely punctured the image that I had of America. So it was kind of shocking. I hadn't seen beauty pageants before. That idea that there was darkness there, like, I had no idea. I thought everyone lived happily here and everything was solved within 30 minutes and everybody loved each other. And so that idea that something can go so horrifically wrong, I think, was pretty shocking to me. It is an American story for a bunch of different reasons, including, like, the beauty pageants, which is uniquely an American phenomenon.
Then why you? Like, why is this your story to tell?
Good point. I mean, I guess... I don't know. I feel like often that's why we got a bit of criticism in the reviews, is that people think I am making fun of America, or that I am being a little too critical or too, because I am not American. But I don't know, part of me, it's sort of my story to tell because it's about women and it's about women's representation in the media and it's about sexuality and it's about childhood. And these are all themes I had touched on in every film I've made. So it kind of fit into my body of work and what I do and how I do it. And even, like, my mother is a photographer and she makes films about domesticity and motherhood. And so, like, it's sort of something I grew up around. So it's this idea that it fit thematically. And then my just fascination with America as, like, as a foreigner, an alien on my visa. Yeah, I don't know. It's just sort of all fit together. Like, I wanted to do it and they let me. Sometimes you do need an outsider looking in as well. Like, sometimes that can be a good thing.
I certainly didn't read all of the reviews, but, you know, of the ones that frustrated me, I mean, and what you're talking about is that the sense that we encounter a lot with True False, where it's, you know, not giving people, regular people, folks, enough credit as sort of, like, thinking, literate, media literate entities. And, you know, like, this idea that, like, somehow you're, like, perpetrating this sort of, like, high-minded art fraud on these, like, simpletons from Boulder, Colorado. Like, that strikes me actually as like, an egregious example of somebody actually just, like, not trusting people and, you know, and looking down on people and being snobbish in a way that is really frustrating to me.
Yeah, definitely. Especially when it's coming out of, like, you know, people sitting in their offices in New York City, assuming that these people from Colorado don't have any agency. And then my cast in Colorado are writing to me saying, this is condescending. And can we please write to them and tell them that we're not, you know, that we had a voice in this and that we were part of creating this project, that we weren't being used? Point where I was like, I'm not sure if we should engage. Like, we got a bunch of us together thinking, how do we deal with some of the things that are being said? Like, how do we, you know, take it back and make it ours? And in the end, like, I'm not sure we did enough. I think we should have really issued. They wanted to write a letter to the editor, certain publication, and we never really did it in the, because we were worried about, like, giving the article more power. But I kind of regret that. I think maybe we should have and we didn't at the time, and I learned my lesson.
Does it change how you think about making movies going forward at all? You read your reviews, but does it fuel, like, a fire in you? Do you want to, like, prove them wrong? What's your response?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I think a lot of it, I feel like, and this is going to sound silly, and a lot of people tell me this isn't true, but I feel like a lot of people don't trust me because I'm a young woman, and they haven't seen, a lot of them, the other work I've created. So this idea that I'm new, fresh on the scene with something that's so provocative and so bizarre that they can't make sense of because I don't have, like, a long body of work for them to go back to reference. One thing I would like to just do is to continue doing what I do until they figure out, oh, she knows what she's doing. Like, she knows, like, where the line is, and she's playing with the line in a way that is intelligent, as opposed to being me just stumbling into this or, like, accidentally making this film. So it's almost like that idea that I have to kind of keep making purposeful decisions and keep doing what I'm doing in order to almost give JonBenet back some legitimacy. I don't know. And not that it doesn't have any now, but, like, the other thing is, I mean, that's one aside to it. And then I worry that, I mean, documentarians are held to a very different moral standard than fiction filmmakers. And I think if we had have labeled this film a fiction film, it would have had a completely different response. The idea that it's a documentary scares people, and there's all these rules that documentarians need to follow. And we're cheeky. We are a documentary, but we're an experimental documentary, so we're not playing, like, we're not following the rules. And I think that scares people. It doesn't make me want to change the way I do things.
That's it for this episode of the True False podcast. You can watch Casting JonBenet on Netflix. Find our podcast at kbia.org and on iTunes, and join us next time as we discuss a different aspect of the art and craft of nonfiction storytelling. Thanks to Kitty Green and David Wilson for the interview. This episode was produced by Abby Ivory Gagne and edited by Ryan Famuliner and Bram Sablesmith. Our music was created by Tim Pilcher using sounds from the True False Film Fest. I'm Allison Kofeld. Thanks for listening.